4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Generation Anthropocene, the program where we ask the question, what does it mean to be living in the new geologic age? I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today we'll be featuring an interview with journalist and environmental historian John Christensen. Stay tuned.
I'm Samantha Larson. I'm sitting here with John Christensen, historian and director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West. Hi, John.
Hi.
As you may know, one of the themes of this podcast series is that we're entering a new geologic era called the Anthropocene, which can be framed in many different ways. And we're trying to investigate kind of what might be the start of the Anthropocene. Some ideas thrown out are the agricultural revolution or the industrial revolution or the Great Acceleration after World War II. One way that I kind of thought of framing it was that the start of the Anthropocene would be when the end of the narrative of the frontier happened. It seems to me that the concept of there being a frontier has been crucial in many ways to social development so far, that there's space out there to push into. It's most obvious in America, where we've actually reached across the continent and are now well established and have been for a while. So I was wondering what you thought of this as a way of framing the Anthropocene, or whether you think that it's true that the narrative of the frontier is over.
I hadn't thought about that, and I think it's a really interesting way of thinking about the Anthropocene. I mean, I think if we think about the Anthropocene as really beginning, or at least our consciousness of it beginning when the idea of the frontier ends. In that sense, I mean, it is as if the idea of the frontier kept open the illusion that there was more nature out there that was as yet, you know, unaffected by human beings. And you know, that's really the myth of the frontier. That really never did exist, right? I mean, the continent was populated by not only peoples, you know, but by empires, by great civilizations before the arrival of Europeans. You know, if you think about the advance of the frontier finally arriving at the shores of the Pacific, as the poet Robinson Jeffers, you know, sometimes thought of that, and, you know, reaching continent's end. You know, that's also a kind of myth, because California and the West Coast were part of a much larger Pacific world way before they were part of the United States. And so I think your idea is like an interesting one if we think about it as like the, you know, how the frontier provided this myth that for a very long time that there was not part of the earth that was affected by human beings. And I think that myth is still somewhat alive in, you know, in places like, you know, the Amazon, or, you know, in ideas like wilderness, that there may still be places out there unaffected by human beings, unaffected by the Anthropocene. But I think the, you know, the arrival of the Anthropocene is kind of that sense that really there is nowhere that is not affected by people.
Is there a boundary that you think happened when there was suddenly nowhere that was not affected by people?
You know, I think if we think about it as the period in which the earth is affected by people, that's very, very difficult to say when it began. I think fire would be a really important marker of that, because, you know, it begins to manage landscapes on a very grand scale, you know, with people lighting fire to the landscape to manage Aboriginal, Native American, you know, it's a basic human tool for managing landscapes is using fire. And then bringing fire inside, bringing fire then inside our machines to run our machines, you know, that really begins to accelerate the way in which we see human beings shaping the planet as a whole. But I have my own date for the beginning of the Anthropocene, which I'd be happy to test out on you and see what you think about it. But I think the Anthropocene begins in a very precise time and place, and it's in 2000. When Paul Crutzen publishes his essay, Have We Entered the Anthropocene? And the reason why I think it begins at that precise time and place is because I think it's as good a marker as any of how what's important about the Anthropocene may not be when did human beings begin affecting the planet, you know, and begin shaping the planet. Because as we talked about, that's so hard to determine. And it's been this continuous process. And to sort of decide one point or another, you can debate about it. But I think the important part of it is, when did we begin to have consciousness of it, to think about it, to begin to talk about it? And that if we define the Anthropocene as beginning, you know, and Paul Crutzen's, you know, article is thought by many people to be, you know, a beginning, although there were some talk of some concepts before that. But right now, it's kind of, it is a marker of when we began to be conscious of it, to debate it, to think about it as the Anthropocene. And I think it's both that reality and the consciousness of it that mark the Anthropocene.
So you talked a little bit about the mythology of the frontier and the mythology of wilderness and the sort of romanticization of exploration. And that part of the reason why it is a mythology is that there have been all these other cultures that were, in a sense, displaced by the advancement of the myth. How do you think that exploration itself as a concept compares within the cultural construct of the frontier?
What do you mean by exploration?
I mean, the big narrative of the frontier is encroaching into unexplored space.
Right.
Quote unquote unexplored space.
So the big change in the last generation of historians who have studied, you know, what we call the frontier and exploration has been to see this process as much more of an encounter between different peoples, between different civilizations, between different empires, between different ways of living and thinking and, you know, living on the earth than as an exploration into unknown territory. Mm-hmm. I mean, which is not to say that there aren't new things to discover in places where people haven't been. Certainly the exploration of some of the Arctic regions were very likely, you know, Antarctica to the depths of the sea and so on, you know. But I mean, in most places, you know, we've really begun in the last generation of history to think about these as processes of encounters. Mm-hmm. And that's really changed the way that frontier is thought of.
I saw that you've encouraged some students to retrace the steps of some of the heroes of the mythology of the frontier, however. And given that there are so many flaws in the mythology that maybe it's not really a valid concept, what value do you think there is in retracing the steps of those explorers like John Muir?
The reason we go back and look at history is, you know, one, to try to understand the past, but two is really for the present. and for the future and how we think about the possibilities around us today. And so I think there is value in going back and using, you know, some of those journeys, those explorations, those voyages to see certainly the most simple thing, how has the landscape changed? Mm-hmm. But then more importantly, how have our ideas about the landscape changed? Take John Muir. I mean, John Muir is really the person who set up the way that we think about California today.
Yeah.
As being, you know, the cities where most people live. Contrary to sort of the mythology, John Muir enjoyed coming to the city, although he, you know, he enjoyed the wilderness cathedrals more. But so you have the cities, then you have the productive landscape of farms and ranches and mines, and then you have the wilderness cathedrals of nature. And these were really three separate kinds of landscapes. We are still living in John Muir's California, but it's changing.
Mm-hmm.
We're beginning to see that those all those values and ideas really are mixed up across that landscape, that the city is also full of nature. The productive landscape is full of, you know, all kinds of ideas about the natural ecosystems and the things that they provide to us, as well as, you know, the productivity that they give to human economies. And we see now, you know, in the Anthropocene that even the wilderness is a product of human forces and is very much shaped by human ideas.
Mm-hmm. So I was particularly interested in the kind of historical recreation that you did yourself in retracing Steinbeck's and Ed Rickett's voyage to the Sea of Cortez. What was the motivation behind that project?
Yeah, so I mean, again, it's not a recreation. It's part, I mean, to come back to the questions that you asked about exploration, I think it's an important question. Can we go back to places that other people have been, which is most of the world, right, and see things with fresh eyes? The challenge was then really thinking about, how can you do this? Why do this? Your question is a really good one that I think is really important to ask about anything like this. It's like, why are you doing it? You know, are you trying to relive the past? Or is there something really new that you're doing and that you're bringing to it? You know, there were other parts of it that were, you know, still the same kind of, you know, magical feeling of being out there on the boat at dawn in the fog and, you know, hearing whales blowing all around the boat.
On the subject of change, as part of our podcast introduction, there's a statement that history is accelerating. Do you think that human attitudes and behavior towards the environment is also changing at an accelerating pace? And is it changing at a fast enough pace to keep up with the rate at which the Earth itself is changing?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I'd want to get out my calculator and, you know, do some formulas here and see what I think about these statements about pace. I mean, I think we all live in a sense that, you know, with a sense that the world has never been as fast-paced, you know, as confusing, as troublesome, as dangerous, as close to the end times as, you know, any previous generation. And that's a very, very common human feeling and trope throughout history. So I'm a little bit skeptical of it because it's so common. But I think at the same time, I mean, there's no denying that the signs of change in warming, in, you know, habitat, and all kinds of measures have been accelerating. But at the same time, you know, in the United States right now, conservation and development on an annual basis are pretty much on par. Conservation is beginning to shape the landscape just as much as development on a permanent basis, because most conservation is thought of as in perpetuity. Population, although it's increasing, is beginning, you know, we're beginning to see that it will plateau. I think it's important for us to be, you know, aware of the kind of shape of these changes and not just focus on the that kind of common feeling that we're going to hell in a handbasket.
Uh-huh. How long were you a journalist, and what prompted the change from journalism?
Well, you know, I say, and it's true, I still have ink in my veins. You know, I mean, it's hard for me to say I was a journalist. I really still am a journalist, and maybe it's once a journalist, always a journalist. I mean, I'm right now working on, you know, several pieces of journalism, and you know, it's evolved over time from doing kind of reporting on stories to more often I'm doing essays now.
What kind of topics do you write about now?
It's still about people and the environment. Uh-huh. I mean, that's the, I think, you know, that's, what else is there? You know, that's the big, you know, that's the big subject that interests me. I mean, for a very long time, I've been interested in conservation and our ideas about conservation and how we measure things. How do we know whether we're, you know, doing what we think we're doing? How to do for, you know, accountability, for learning, for getting better, for actually accomplishing the things that we want to do in terms of, you know, conserving habitat or species or, mm-hmm. you know, other things. That has led to a real interest in the relationship between conservation and development. I think they often go hand in hand rather than being opposed to each other. That's true in the area where we are in Silicon Valley and in the Bay Area, and, you know, quite beautiful history of that kind of relationship. And more recently, I've been getting through that path, getting very interested in ideas of what I call ecological urbanism. Mm-hmm. So the city and metropolitan areas as ecosystems, you know, and that's a very modern, contemporary term, but also thinking about it historically. How have people thought about the relationship of nature and natural processes within cities and metropolitan regions? And, you know, and I think of these metropolitan regions as also being, you know, very capacious. I mean, from the city center out through the suburbs, mm-hmm. you know, through that productive landscape, you know, out to the wild areas as being really one system, mm-hmm. or one, you know, one whole thing to think about, you know, rather than sort of segmenting them the way that John Muir did.
As the world is moving towards increasingly urban populations or suburban populations, how do you think that people's relationship with nature is going to change? Do you think that that's enough, focusing on nature interacting within these systems is enough to establish that deep connection to people with nature, to get them to care about
I think that's the, what is it, you know, the 9 billion person question, you know, for our century. We're the, you know, the population of the Earth is expected to grow from 7 to 9, maybe 10 billion. Most of that, actually all of that population growth is expected to end up in cities over the next 40, 50 years. That means that, you know, we just went through this huge demographic transition globally where half of the people on Earth now live in urban areas. All of the future growth is one way or another going to be absorbed in urban areas. And most of those urban areas are not going to be the glamorous megacities of Tokyo and New York, London. They're going to be cities of 200,000, you know, dozens, hundreds of these cities we've never even heard of, that over the next half century are going to grow to 700,000 to a million people. And I think that the way that those cities grow and absorb that population, expand and grow, and thereby affect the environment around them, the you know, whether it's the suburbs or shanty towns or the agricultural landscapes or the wild landscapes or the protected areas, you know, that they're going to grow up against or maybe even take over, that the next 50 years is going to determine so much about the future of life on Earth for people and, you know, the way that we live, our relations with each other and with nature, as well as the natural landscapes or those kind of hybrid landscapes of people and nature. That's the big question, you know, for your generation.
Do you think we can look to history and historical development in constructing how the future development of these cities should
happen? I think there are some things that we can use from history. That's why I'm a historian. That's why I like being a historian and why I believe in doing history for the present and the future.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to live in the past. I enjoy being alive now. And I think, you know, these are worthy challenges. And I think if we look back, say, at the history of conservation in the United States in metropolitan areas, let's take the Bay Area as an example, although, you know, this example is repeated in different ways in many different cities around the United States. You know, the kind of practices and thinking about conservation go from the very beginning concern with protecting watersheds to provide clean water for people. They then go often to enclosing the commons, the areas that people use for grazing and other purposes, and making parks. Mm-hmm. Those parks often then being for the recreation and well-being of good citizens, and, you know, the creation of beautiful cities, the City Beautiful movement. We're beginning to get, you know, at the kind of 19th turn of the 20th, you know, century, and then later in the 20th century, an interest in preserving, protecting open space for aesthetic reasons, for views, you know, the view of the bay, the view of the foothills. And that then evolves into protecting open space for habitat, for other species that we share this earth with. And then, you know, we begin to see that now evolving into talk about protecting nature, open space, parks for ecosystem services.
Right.
And we kind of come back to the beginning, you see, I mean, to the ecosystem services like clean water that those natural areas provide for us. And so I think over the course of our own American history, we have a whole suite of tools, and I mean by tools, ideas as well as practices for thinking about conservation in a metropolitan context that could be used in a lot of different contexts, you know, a lot of different cultural, historical, political, economic contexts. I don't think that this, you know, this model can just be exported to the booming cities of Africa or Asia, but I think that it can be adapted. I think within that spectrum, you see a lot of very useful ideas about how cities and economic development and human beings, you know, need and, you know, have a productive relationship with natural areas that provides the things that people and communities need. And so I do have some hope that this sort of toolbox of ideas could be adapted and useful in a lot of different contexts. Now that we're trying to, like, daylight streams that were put into concrete and we're spending millions of dollars trying to bring nature back into urban and metropolitan areas, would we have been better off if those streams had never been channelized and lined with concrete? Yes. You know, I think so. You know, and that's why I think looking at this whole suite of ideas now as a kind of toolbox that could be adapted, you know, I think maybe that could be used in ways that avoid some of those mistakes. If you think about this whole set of tools and, you know, these cities that are going to boom around the world from 200,000 to a million people, is there a kind of set of tools, you know, that could be used in a good ways that perhaps could avoid the costly mistakes that have to be come back and be corrected?
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that in the stage of creating the parks, and maybe this isn't universally true, but that the parks that were created were like the granite walls of Yosemite or like the high mountains that probably didn't need as much protection, that they're remote enough that they're not going to be hugely developed or maybe even less biologically diverse. What do you think the interplay of human aesthetic and like the appeal of those types of landscapes versus protecting the landscapes that are actually crucially important? Or do you think there's even a paradox there?
No, I definitely think there is. I mean, I think you've put your finger on something really important, which is a lot of our efforts have been put on protecting landscapes that are not threatened. That still continues to be true. I mean, there's a lot of money spent on conservation easements, on ranch lands and agricultural lands that probably have a very, very low threat being developed. And I do think we have a big problem with this kind of priority right now, and that if we could change our priorities to invest more conservation dollars in communities that are underserved by conservation right now, in states that don't get as much money, states like Montana, get Colorado, Wyoming, get a lot of money. There's a lot of big conservation going on there. States like Georgia, Alabama, not so much. Uh-huh. I mean, I think if we could help people shift their priorities. And I think this is part of a big change that's happening in conservation now, focusing on, nature for people. Where are the priorities? If you looked at, instead of looking at how many acres can you save for X dollars, if you put people into that equation and say, how many people can benefit from this conservation investment, it has the potential to really change the way that we think about the priorities.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining
me. Oh, well, thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song, Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?